It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
From the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., backed by the trusted voices of Team Fox. Team Fox, a clear, fresh voice cutting through the noise to tell the truth. It's the Guy Benson Show with Guy Benson.
It is Thursday, June 1st, 2023, a brand new broadcast month. Coming your way here on the Guy Benson Show. I'm your host, Guy Benson, live in New York City today. Very glad to have you here. Thank you for listening. Between 3 and 6 p.m. Eastern, that's every weekday. We've got a podcast if you miss any of it. It is free. It is on demand at GuyBensonShow.com or FoxNewsPodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Plus, bonus Benson on the weekends. Lots of options for that. Totally no charge to you. When the show is over, it's available within minutes. I'm the political editor at townhall.com, also a Fox News contributor. Very busy day today, including this evening. Kennedy will have me on her program. She will have Kat Timpf and yours truly in studio together in the back half of the 7 p.m. hour Eastern time on Fox Business Network. And it's going to be, I would say, a poignant edition of Kennedy's show. More on that later. Hope to see you there. That's FBN, probably around 7:40 Eastern or so tonight. And then at 11 p.m. Eastern, it's Gutfeld. I'll be on the panel for that full hour. Looking forward to that. That's Fox News Channel late tonight. So set your DVRs or tune in live. Here's the lineup on the radio side. Brian Riedel, one of our trusted budget wonks, will be here talking about the debt ceiling deal. Yesterday, while we were on the air, we covered live as the House passed the so-called rule to then move on to debate and final passage for the debt ceiling negotiated package. And it ended up passing by a huge margin, more than 300 votes. A majority of Republicans voted yes. A majority of Democrats voted yes on the final bill. So it moves to the Senate. Is it good? Sort of meh? Is it bad? Is it horrendous? From a budgetary perspective, like if you care about fiscal conservatism, constraining spending, that sort of thing, we'll get a review from Brian Riedel. Someone who thinks it's a very bad deal is Chip Roy, Republican congressman from Texas. He was one of the loudest no's on this bill, a dissenter, one of the dozens of Republicans who voted against it. He will be our guest coming up in the next hour today. Chad Pergram, Fox's man on Capitol Hill. No one understands the ins and outs of Hill dealings and how the sausage gets made better than Chad. What comes next? Like, obviously, if you know your schoolhouse rock, it goes over to the Senate now. But will that be easy, a piece of cake? Does that get done tonight? Does that get done tomorrow? What does this mean for some of the eventual additional deadlines and cliffs that seem to always be looming in Washington? We will get those details from Chad. And then Will Cain, co-host of Fox and Friends Weekend. We always have good conversations with Will here. I think today will probably be another one. We're talking about Pride Month, culture wars, and sports. We touched on some of this in recent shows. There are some developments involving the Los Angeles Dodgers, now a player for the Toronto Blue Jays. There's an on-air personality at ESPN who's been under fire. And battle lines are being drawn. Some people are receding from the fight. Some people are leaning into the fight. Obviously, I come at this from sort of an interesting perspective as a conservative who happens to be gay and a big sports fan. Will is two of those things. I'll let you guess which ones. And we'll have him here just after 5 p.m. Eastern time for probably a pretty thoughtful conversation. He's a smart guy. So that is all ahead on the program here today. I want to start on the issue of crime, one that we have committed to you. We will continue to follow on this show. I think part of that is just like I have a burr under my saddle, not just because public safety matters, punishing and deterring crime matters. the safety of innocent people matters. But you also had a bunch of gaslighting people on the left and in the media. But I repeat myself. Prior to the 2022 midterm elections, saying that this was just a ploy by conservatives to scare people and the crime thing would just go away after the election because it would be no longer useful. Well, it's debatable how useful it was in the midterm elections. I think it played a major role in places like New York and California, maybe not as much elsewhere as I would have liked or should have, but the issue remains and in some ways is getting worse. So, as a related note to that, I'll just point this out. Remember Chesa Boudin, who was the hyper-woke, criminal-coddling DA who was elected in San Francisco back in 2019? He did such a bad job. It was so disastrous, his term, that the people of San Francisco cut it short. They used the recall provision to throw him out of office and to do so decisively before even his term was complete. It was that bad. Now, things aren't really getting a lot better as we talk about here on the show. People just, you know, leaving the city in droves, not just residents, but businesses. We talked about, what was it, Neiman Marcus or Nordstrom's pulling out of downtown San Francisco, the whole issue at Whole Foods. It's still a very big problem, even without Boudin. Boudin is the child of an unrepentant terrorist and was raised by another unrepentant terrorist, Bill Ayers. And then they decided to put him in charge of law enforcement in San Francisco. So you'd say the generic, you know, what could go wrong? Well, a lot of things, so much so that even the left-wing people of SF were like, enough. And I was sort of wondering where he would land next. Since he could no longer help the criminals do more crimes by being soft on crime in the name of progress and equity, what would he do with his time? He made an announcement a few months ago saying he was not planning to seek office, at least in the near term, but it's been mostly crickets from the world of Chesa Boudin until this. Someone hired him. Place your bets. Okay, ready? If you were guessing academia, come collect your prize. Of course. He's going to help train the next generation of lawyers to be a little bit more like him. The University of California at Berkeley, of course, law school, tweeting this yesterday, welcoming Chesa Boudin as founding executive director of Berkeley Law's new Criminal Law and Justice Center. Boudin sees an exciting opportunity to build on his work of transforming the criminal legal system in profound ways. Oh, yeah, he's an expert in that. He did some profound transforming, didn't he, in San Francisco? So much so that the people of that city, who are not conservatives, said enough is enough, gave him the boot, and now UCal Berkeley's like, come on into the law school. Let's do the transformation here. One of his fellow acolytes, and one of these Soros-funded prosecutors, south of San Francisco in Los Angeles, George Gascon, was able to avert a recall effort. And that's too bad, because the terrible, harmful policies that he continues to pursue in that city are putting lives at risk and, in fact, costing innocent people their lives. Bill Malugin had this report about, it feels now like a dog bites man situation, a violent repeat offender left out on the streets, with the system deciding that that is what justice required, only to then kill someone. Here's how Malugin spelled it out in Cut 24.
This is a bad one. Critics of LADA George Gascon say this case is yet another egregious example of what can go wrong when Gascon's policies allow violent criminals to avoid incarceration. So take a look. This is Stephen Sutherland. In late November 2020, he was arrested by LAPD after he used a knife to stab the neck of a construction worker who he felt was making too much noise, nearly killing him. He was charged with assault with a deadly weapon with an enhancement for great bodily injury. And sources tell me the LA County Probation Department recommended a prison sentence for him, with the probation officer writing in part, quote, the defendant must be held accountable for his violent actions. The defendant's conduct is alarming and disturbing. This deputy is concerned about the possibility of future violent outbursts. But that prison recommendation was ignored.
Surprise, surprise. So this guy stabs a stranger in the neck because he was making too much noise. The people who looked at the case said, please put this person behind bars. We are worried this could happen again. That did not happen. And then something else did. Cut 25.
In 2021, progressive L.A. County D.A. George Gascon's administration agreed to give Sutherland mental health diversion instead of incarceration, a decision that proved deadly. Last Tuesday, LAPD arrested Sutherland again, this time for murder, after police say he shot and killed his upstairs neighbor in her own apartment, firing 19 times in the process. The victim, 30-year-old Jennifer Gomez, was pronounced dead on scene with multiple gunshot wounds. Her neighbors told police Sutherland had previously confronted her about making stomping noises in the past. I reached out to LADA George Gascon's office asking how it made any sense to give Sutherland diversion for that next stabbing crime. They responded in part, quote, a court-appointed psychologist deemed him suitable for the treatment program, and our prosecutor agreed to the defense request for mental health diversion.
I mean, that last part's amazing. So this guy stabbed a construction worker who's being too loud, in his mind, in the neck, almost killed him. They didn't charge him with attempted murder, just an aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. Instead of going to prison for that, he was then put into some sort of, you know, psych sort of program, despite warnings, saying this is a violent person prone to outbursts. You need this person incarcerated for the safety of others. But the very progressive, equitable, justice-minded George Gascon in his office said, no, we're going to let this person back on the street. And then he murdered a woman, allegedly shooting 19 times as he ended the life of a 30-year-old woman, Jennifer Gomez, a woman of color, if we're playing those sorts of games, as they so often do in these types of jurisdictions, gone. Because she was making too much noise in the mind of this man who lashes out violently when that happens, 19 shots. And by the way, let me just ask, how did this man have a gun? A lunatic with a violent record? How did he have a gun? In a state like California, where the gun laws are very strict and they pat themselves on the back all the time, it's almost as if people who aren't eligible to have guns somehow get them anyway. Because criminals don't follow laws by definition. 19 shots and the woman is dead. And then the media reaches out to Gascon's office, and rather than saying, we are so sorry for this loss, this was a mistake, this person was too dangerous, obviously, to be let out of this program, and we need to tighten up how we think about this program. They just put out a little statement saying, oh, yeah, the psychologist deemed him suitable. And so we agreed for the defense request, this guy's defense, for this mental health diversion rather than prison. They're proud of it. They're doubling down on it. A young woman is dead completely needlessly, and they're like, yeah, that was the right call. That's George Gascon and Soros-style prosecution in Los Angeles. By the way, and I saw Malugin was tweeting about this as well, just a few weeks ago, another story in Los Angeles. Same jurisdiction, same people in charge. Let me read just a snippet from that FoxNews.com story. This was early May, so just under a month ago. A violent career criminal who was on the streets and not in jail because she was assigned mental health treatment instead of prison time, is now accused of killing an innocent Los Angeles father. Jade Brookfield, 23, was arrested in April and charged with murder after she allegedly fatally stabbed 40-year-old Dennis Banner during an argument in the street. Law enforcement sources tell Fox News that Brookfield, the alleged assailant, had a lengthy criminal history for alleged assault, assault with a deadly weapon, and multiple violent felonies with knives. But she had inexplicably avoided incarceration and was repeatedly given mental health diversions. It took losing a father, a family losing their father, for these diversions to be terminated. And only now is the suspect finally being held in custody. Multiple violent attacks using a knife. They don't put this person in jail because mental health and restorative justice and all the words that they want to use. And now there's a family and kids with a dad who's dead. just like the young woman in her apartment, shot to death by someone else in a very similar situation with a similar profile. And apparently the office of George Gascon says, yep, this is, these are the costs. These are the wages of restorative justice and equity and true social and racial justice or whatever banal slogans they want to use. These are deadly policies. And it's not just California. We see this in Chicago, we give you examples of that. We see this in Philadelphia. We see it here in New York, Washington, D.C. The list goes on. There's something in common in all of those places. It has to do with the ideology of the people making policies. And I guess, but enough innocent people are just going to be sacrificed on the altar of this progress for some failed ideological dangerous project? I mean, on and on it goes. And on we will go covering it so long as people continue to tolerate this. We're just getting started. It is the Guy Benson Show in New York today on this Thursday. We'll be right back.
Not the same talking points here. The Guy Benson Show.
I'm Dana Perino. This week on Perino on Politics, I'm joined by founder and executive director of Power the Future, Daniel Turner, for a look at how we can advocate for a cleaner earth while strengthening U.S. energy independence. Available now on FoxNewsPodcast.com.
I'm Guy Benson. Sticking with the crime theme for just a moment, this story out of Greater Atlanta from the Washington Free Beacon, two Lululemon employees were fired after they called the cops on three masked men pillaging their Atlanta area apparel store. Earlier this month, three thieves burst into the Lululemon store at the Peachtree Corners, grabbing armfuls of athletic clothes. There's some sound here. Cut 27.
No. No.
Seriously. Get out. Get out. Get out.
Video their car. This was on camera. And these employees were trying to get the thieves not to steal. So after this happened, a woman named Jennifer Ferguson, who you just heard there, and fellow employee Rachel Rogers followed them out of the store, did not try to stop them. Instead, they called police, who tracked down the perps and charged them with felony robbery. Lululemon fired the two employees without severance after the incident because the Canadian-based company has a zero-tolerance policy on chasing or physically engaging with a thief. Not a zero-tolerance policy on thieving. A zero-tolerance policy on chasing or engaging with a thief, which they didn't really do. They were trying to prevent the store from getting robbed of more apparel and wanted to get on camera who these people were to try to bring them to justice. Apparently, that was a fireable offense, according to, is it Lululemon or Lululenon? This left-wing company. So now you've got two law-abiding, hardworking people out of a job because they were trying to help authorities catch the people robbing their store. And the people who own the store are like, oh yeah, we found the problem here. It's you. You're fired. It's just amazing. Upside down. Like, I get it. You don't want to get into a violent confrontation. I can see why you would have policies like that. But this seems ridiculously harsh and very misdirected. That's just me. It's the Guy Benson Show. We'll be right back.
Same issues, but with a fresh perspective. The Guy Benson Show.
Glad to have you here on The Guy Benson Show. GuyBensonShow.com. Podcast always free. With us now is Brian Riedel, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, longtime budget wonk and expert on Capitol Hill as well. Brian, welcome back.
Glad to be back.
Okay, so yesterday there was a vote in the House. And the debt ceiling deal brokered by Speaker McCarthy and President Biden passed overwhelmingly, majorities of both parties voting for it in the House. It moves on to the Senate. We'll probably get some TikTok on that from Chad Pergram here a little bit later on in the show. On the substance of it, because we had a member on each side yesterday here making the case against and for the deal. Chip Roy is joining us later. He was one of the sort of strenuous no votes. You can sort of look at the numbers pretty dispassionately and render some judgments. Maybe just walk us through, from a conservative perspective, the good, the bad, the ugly on this bill.
Well, I think on the spending caps, the Republicans will tell you it's a 6-year spending cap. It's actually really only a 2-year spending cap because the other 4 years are not enforced in the bill. There's no enforcement mechanism at all, and so they're not even scored by the Congressional Budget Office as existing. For those 2 years, you begin with a 1% spending cut, which consists of defense going up $28 billion and non-defense going down $40 billion. The problem, however, is there's a lot of gimmicks that are in the bill and that have been that have been promised between the White House and the Republicans to really eliminate most of that $40 billion non-defense cut. There's a lot of tricks and gimmicks. So at the end of the day, we're probably going to end up with about a 3% hike in defense and a freeze in non-defense. And then next year, everything rises by about 1%. So it's not a revolution. It's not a big cut. It is a modest defense hike and probably a freeze in non-defense. Again, it's not great, but it's probably the best we could get.
Okay. There was this score, though, from CBO that says it would save $1.5 trillion in deficits over the period of time that we're talking about here. I'm sure that big number is nowhere near the reality based on the gimmicks that you were talking about, but that at least seems like a pretty big number. Where do they come up with that?
CBO is not measuring the cuts compared to the current spending levels. They're measuring the cuts compared to spending growing by inflation. So in reality, there's no actual $1.3 trillion in cuts. It's $1.3 trillion in growth slower than inflation. But the final 8 years of those savings from the Congressional Budget Office estimate aren't actually capped in the bill. They're assuming that future Congresses keep spending low for the final 8 years, even though the caps only count 2 years. So there's really nothing binding Congress to those final 8 years. And again, there's the fact that even these first 2 years with caps are kind of fake numbers. There's significant gimmicks and promises. And in fact, even in the Senate, it looks like they're going to negotiate a deal where they're going to promise to increase defense spending more in a supplemental bill in order. If that's the case, again, the $1.3 trillion evaporates.
Yeah. I mean, that's the reality of it. And yet you say it's probably the best that Republicans could have gotten. You've seen some of these standoffs over the years. In this case, one of the big differences seemed to be that Republicans passed a bill, a pretty reasonable bill, I should say. Democrats weren't expecting that. So there was some newfound leverage for Speaker McCarthy going into these conversations. You know, I know there are people beating their chest saying this is awful, as if they could have figured out a better resolution here, considering who's across, you know, the table here. It's the Biden team. Of course, there's a Democrat-run Senate. Republicans had better leverage than I thought they would, but still limited leverage because of just the way the power breaks down in Washington right now, based on how voters have behaved in the last couple of cycles. Why do you think this was, despite being, sounds like, very underwhelming in your eyes, still the best they could have done?
Well, I think first, because Republicans only have a slight House majority, as you said. They do not control the Senate. They cannot control the White House. And they were holding a hostage of the debt limit that everyone knew couldn't be shot. Everyone knew the debt limit ultimately had to be raised. So there really wasn't as much leverage as it appeared. And again, when you just have a slight majority in one body and you don't really have the real leverage that you're going to allow you to default, that limits what you can accomplish. But beyond that, Republicans were also limited by the fact that their first priority in the negotiations was to increase defense. And that cost them some leverage on the non-defense cuts. Once they made clear that their first priority was making sure that defense gets the increase, Democrats weren't going to accept a 7 or 8% cut in non-defense if Republicans weren't even going to move at all on Pentagon spending. And so that was just a priority decision by Republicans that limited them a little bit. And ultimately, finally, there was the fact that even when Republicans talked about the original House-passed bill of cutting discretionary spending by 9%, they didn't really have a blueprint, even if they had accomplished that, of where to find those degree of cuts. Like, you know, we had heard rumors of, you know, cutting some domestic programs by 20%. Not sure that was ever realistic, even with Republicans.
Were there process-related improvements in this bill? Because one thing that was at least intriguing to me was some of these mechanisms that Thomas Massie put in there and insisted that helped earn his vote, someone who often votes no on almost everything. He voted yes on this because he was able to, at least what they're telling us, is bring things back to regular order, where it's not just these giant big spending packages crammed together at the very end of the year at the last minute in an omnibus bomb that they then drop on everyone. You have to vote for it and get out of town. This requires all of the relevant committees to go through and actually appropriate through the normal process, which has been largely abandoned by Washington. And if they don't do that based on this deal, then there's an automatic 1% cut, which I think a lot of people, especially on the Democratic side, are going to want to avoid. Is that a meaningful win in this package?
It's helpful. What they're saying is that if all 12 bills aren't finished by January 1st, which is 3 months after the normal deadline anyway, any remaining spending gets cut by 1% for the rest of the year. So what that protects Republicans somewhat. It says if Democrats want to do shenanigans to backfill even more of the cuts and to produce even like a full increase in non-defense spending rather than just a freeze, Republicans have a backdrop. If they can basically block the appropriations bills, not worry about a government shutdown, but have the confidence that the worst-case scenario is a 1% cut for non-defense, that gives Republicans more leverage
right.
to block bad appropriations bills.
And now, is that meaningful? Is there teeth there? Because I know one of the things that people have been talking about and tweeting screen caps of the bill as it moves to the Senate is that there's not actual enforceability on some of these things, particularly certain reforms that they keep talking about. There's a provision right in there in the black and white that some Biden administration bureaucrat can simply waive it. Just say, nope, this is too important. There's a waiver that I'm going to execute and then it's over. Like then the little reform that they're touting as a success just goes away with the snap of fingers of one bureaucrat, on Team Biden. That is sometimes the type of game playing that happens in Washington. Does that apply here, or is this one relatively solid?
Well, that provision says that if the White House creates any regulations that are going to have an extremely high cost, they have to find offsetting regulations or offsetting legislation to offset the cost of those regulations. The first caveat is the policy expires after 18 months. And the second caveat is the White House can waive it if they determine that it's a really important regulation or that it's necessary for the operation of government, which is a loophole large enough to drive a truck through.
Yeah, that's meaningless, but that's different. That's a different provision that we're talking about than the regular order restoration piece from Massie. Any other elements of this bill, like little bits and pieces that you think are particularly good or helpful or, on the other hand, alarming for conservatives?
I mean, restarting student loan payments at the end of summer is helpful, even though Republicans had wanted to cancel the full bailout. At least now they're going to have it in law that Biden can't do any shenanigans. They're going to have to restart student loan payments at the end of the summer. There's minor permitting reform that's going to make it easier for construction projects to go forward without as much red tape. The work requirements for SNAP kind of went backwards. They actually ended up with reforms that will add 78,000 people to the SNAP program. So that kind of – Republicans kind of got – dropped the ball on that one to the extent that they otherwise wanted to help people progress out of SNAP by working more. So overall, you know, it's some minor victories. I still think it's better than nothing. it's probably the best they could get. But it's not a revolution. But you know, you got to win more elections if you want a revolution.
Yeah, right. In order to do big things, you need to win more elections, especially if the Democrats aren't going to go along with the big things that you want to do. One thing that I've heard from some people, and I think former President Trump has sort of toyed with this publicly as well, which he didn't do when he was president. It's easier to do it when you're not president, as he just openly admitted in that CNN town hall. But some people say, you know, why not just default? Right. The experts told us that all these different things about COVID, and they were wrong. The experts are often wrong about a lot of things. Oh, the experts say a default would be so, so bad for the economy. Is that really true? Why not just, drive a harder bargain and let us go over that cliff and see what happens? What's your answer to that, Brian?
I think you're playing that's playing with fire. If you go over the cliff, Congress or the White House and then the administration have to immediately eliminate 20% of all federal spending. And it's not even a clear 20% because revenue and spending come in at different times. Some weeks you're wiping out 60% of the budget. Other weeks you're paying all the bills. Social Security checks may not go out. Doctors may not be reimbursed. Any government contractor or anyone dependent on the federal government for business, for contract or for sale, they're not going to get paid. They're going to be laying people off. I think ultimately that approach would probably create such a backlash that Republicans would have to run in and re-cancel and re-raise the debt limit 3 days later. It's not an effective way to achieve your goal.
All right. One more thing that I want to ask you about, Brian, and you and I have talked about this before, and I've said it on the air here, on TV, in writing. What frustrates me a lot about these conversations is we're having these drawn out, angry debates about really just kind of fiddling with a few numbers at the margins. I mean, we're talking about a small fraction of federal spending that's even subject to potential freezing or minor cuts here, because the biggest drivers of the long-term debt, Medicare, Social Security, these big entitlement programs, they are going insolvent. The government bookkeepers say they're going insolvent. The insolvency dates keep getting moved up closer and closer. But for political reasons, you know, the Democrats want to expand these programs, which is crazy. The Republicans don't want to get hammered, especially among senior citizens, all the fear-mongering that goes on here. So it was sort of agreed in a bipartisan way, we're not going to touch that here, where it's completely off the table. I get why, again, for political reasons, but I also see the math and get very, very angry that very few people seem to take this stuff seriously. Speaker McCarthy, and I've heard him say this in public and in private, he feels like real reform on those fronts will not happen and cannot happen until there's some bipartisan buy-in. He's talking about a commission. When I hear about commissions, I think about super committees and that sort of thing. My eyes just roll back in my head, Brian, like, oh, here we go again, this stupid playbook that means nothing. You're saying let's be not quite that cynical. What's your take on this?
Well, you're absolutely right that ultimately we're just nibbling around the edges. I mean, Social Security and Medicare are running a $400 billion shortfall this year, and a decade from now they're going to be running a $2 trillion annual shortfall. They drive 100% of the long-term deficit. But we do need a bipartisan push. Neither party can fix this by themselves because the politics are just too brutal. And whether or not a commission succeeds, commissions can be successful if both parties are actually truly dedicated and committed to fixing it. Those commissions have worked. If leadership is involved, committee chairmen are involved, and both parties say, this is the mechanism by which we're going to fix it. More often, commissions are a check-the-box exercise to pretend you did something.
Right.
Or to win somebody's vote for an upcoming bill, you give them a commission. And then you staff it with backbench partisans with explicit instructions not to agree to anything. If that's what this is, then yeah, it'll be a joke. But if Republicans and Democratic leaders both really mean it, then it could be useful.
Yeah, if. That's a big if, and I'm skeptical. But, I mean, something has to be done. The math is what it is, and the cliff is growing closer, and it's not one of these little annual annoying cliffs. It's a giant one with huge implications for people. So I know we agree on that, Brian. Let's leave it there for now. Brian Riedel, Manhattan Institute Senior Fellow, budget expert who spent many years on Capitol Hill on the Republican side. Brian, appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Guy.
We'll be right back on The Guy Benson Show after this break.
Always fresh, always fair. The Guy Benson Show.
Glad to have you here on The Guy Benson Show. Still to come, Congressman Chip Roy of Texas, Chad Pergram, our colleague here at Fox News, Will Kane, for an interesting conversation in our final hour. Fox News alert, just getting this video in a few minutes ago, President Joe Biden was out in Colorado Springs at the Air Force Academy, congratulating and addressing graduates there, had shaken a lot of hands. He was on stage, and it appears that he tripped over a sandbag that was on stage, and I'm just watching the video right now. He shakes one cadet's hand, and then he starts walking towards one side of the stage, doesn't see, apparently, the bag, and just trips right over it. He tries to stop himself from falling, but he can't. He goes down hard, and he tries to get back up and struggles to get back up. He's assisted by Secret Service, it looks like, and someone else. He points down at the bag that he tripped over. It's this black sandbag. I don't know what on earth it was doing, just dropped in the middle of the stage. He didn't see it. Tripped on it. Based on the reports that we're getting, he's doing fine and sort of popped back up with some assistance. But, I mean, it was not a minor stumble. He tripped and fell pretty hard. And it's just, it's tough to watch. Not as tough, I think, as when he was going up those steps to Air Force One and really couldn't get his footing, where he fell multiple times. But this was a fall. Now, it's not his fault. People trip over things all the time. If you didn't see this thing on the ground, you wouldn't expect it to be there. That could happen to anyone. But there is a concern when you are 80 years old, falls can be scarier. Falls can be catalyst events for other things. And he's got the best care in the world, and we wish him well. Hopefully it's very minor bruising, if that. The video is a little tough, and that just happened. You don't really see that every day, president going down that hard in public. So want to bring that to you. Just a little update here. Our best to President Biden on that front. Another hour of The Guy Benson Show. Straight ahead, Chip Roy joins us when we come back.
A new generation of conservative talk right here, right now. Fair. Fun and backed by the trusted voices and reporting resources of Fox News.
Fox News.
You're listening to The Guy Benson Show. And now, here's your host, Guy Benson.
It's a brand new hour on The Guy Benson Show from New York. Thank you for being here. GuyBensonShow.com, our online home. Our podcast is always free on demand when the show is over. Catch me this evening on Kennedy's show, Fox Business Network. It's one that you do not want to miss. Just trust me. We'll talk more about that later on. And then Gutfeld tonight on the news channel, 11 p.m. Eastern. Always look forward to that as well. Fox News alert. The Dow up 153 points at the close, finishing just a hair above 33,000, 33,061 on the day. With us now, Congressman Chip Roy, Republican of Texas, the 21st District. And Congressman, good to have you back as always.
Great to be on, Guy.
All right. So there was the vote yesterday in the House. Obviously, it didn't go the way that you were hoping for. You were making the case against the debt ceiling compromise bill, ended up passing by more than 300 votes, majority of Republicans, majority of Democrats, and now it moves over to the Senate. It's happened, right? It's the argument, at least in the House, is over. Feel free to make some of your top points why you think it was a bad bill. Do you have any sense that there could be movement in the Senate on this, or is this almost a done deal in your mind now?
No, it's pretty much a done deal, which is, you know, which is fundamentally the problem, right? I mean, for the American people out there frustrated, this is the uniparty or the cartel or whatever you want to talk about, the swamp, when it does what it does, to just, hey, guys, we have to get a deal done, so do a deal. And that's what happened. It's a maybe slightly better deal than we might have had we not been negotiating all year, working to get Limit Save Grow. But it ain't a hell of a lot better. That's why I'm frustrated, right? I mean, notwithstanding the talking points from the Speaker's office and my colleagues who supported the bill, Let's not forget, by the way, that more Democrats than Republicans voted for the bill, and far more Republicans than Democrats voted no. Let's not forget how many Democrats are out there today applauding it and saying, hey, can we now actually acknowledge that we got a really good deal? I mean, the fact is, it's $4 trillion for, at best, a two-year spending freeze. That's it. I'll challenge anybody to debate me on that point. That's what it is. You can call it a massive cut, the biggest cut in history, all these words, but it's just simply not true. And anybody objectively looking at the math can say that's not true. It's effectively a two-year spending freeze. And, again, you get effectively a $4 trillion debt ceiling increase. I say effectively because it's an uncapped date, right? It's January 1st, 2025. So it's an estimate that it will be about $4 trillion. It leaves in all of the subsidies, you know, for the Green New Deal, so to speak, that the Biden administration said will, quote, accelerate implementation of the historic clean energy and environmental justice investments in the Inflation Reduction Act. It's got watered-down SNAP requirements. It actually increased the number of people that will apply and would cost $2.1 billion, according to CBO. I can keep going down the list, the IRS and everything else. The bottom line is, it is what it is. The swamp won. We had a pretty good spring. We just had a big setback. And the only people applauding this are all the Wall Street types who are like, oh, my God, default.
So
most average Americans are thanking us for fighting.
So I just do want to ask you, because there were some obviously very strong conservatives who ended up voting for this deal, pointing to various provisions that they liked. I mean, you know, Thomas Massie, he is not someone who will just go along to get along. That's he votes. Sometimes he'll be the only guy voting against something on a pretty regular basis. He got something in the bill that he thought was important, so he got to yes. A guy like Jim Jordan, I don't think that people are going to say he's a bad conservative or, you know, a weak conservative. I'm not putting those words in your mouth. But are there things that you can understand why some of your very conservative colleagues eventually drew a different conclusion than you did on this?
Well, again, I always hate to talk to people. They're my talk about people and other people's votes. They're my friends. I prefer them to speak for themselves. I would make a couple of observations. The 20 who stood up in January were the 20 for a reason, and the 20 all vote no. What I mean by that is the Freedom Caucus. And by the way, some of those, like Thomas, for example, is not in the Freedom Caucus. It's not exactly all monolithic, right? And some people who get their committeeships, their committee chairmanships, they start voting a little differently. They start acting a little differently. And look, with all due respect, I don't think that the 1% addition at the end of the year, which means on January 1st, there would be a 1% cap reduction if we haven't passed all 12 appropriations bills. I don't think it'll have the effect that my friend from Kentucky thinks it will. Again, I'll let him speak for himself. I'm just saying I don't think it'll work that way. I think the swamp will basically jam an omnibus through in December, using the same pressure points they just used to pass a $4 trillion debt increase.
I mean, that's entirely possible. There's a chance that maybe it'll look a little bit better because of some of these changes that they've made. Is there anything in the bill, and I know that, you know, you've made your case against it, is there anything in there that you think it's, like, at least not so bad? Like, there's some components that are decent?
Yeah, of course. Two things. I mean, I always appreciate your show, and I always try to be honest about what I see on these things. I've been beating the snot out of it, so let me zero in. Like Garrett Graves, he's a good friend. He did, I think, good work getting some of the NEPA reforms, which are the regulatory reforms that halt a lot of the ability to produce both energy and roads. They've been long needed to get those reforms. Now, a little caveat, the problem is that if you're subsidizing green energy, you're not going to get the actual NEPA to be working for you for the non-green, i.e. the fossil fuel energy and the gas-fired plant, because the investments aren't going that way. But that aside, the NEPA regulations are an improvement. And then it's getting some cuts, upwards of $40 billion, although I would question that number, of cuts from the the bureaucratic state, what you would call non-defense discretionary spending. That is a step forward. It's not as big of a step forward as I would have preferred. And this is an important part. Sorry to filibuster.
No, it's fine.
They're playing some games, right? They went in and they said, well, we're rescinding COVID money. $29 billion. I could say that's a good thing. But the problem is $6 billion of it is actually rescinded. The other roughly $22 billion is sitting over in an account in the Department of Commerce to be used to go backfill a lot of these non-defense discretionary accounts, because that's the way Washington works. That's why I say I believe I'm correct, and a lot of smart guys out there look at this. The Heritage Foundation, like Paul Winfrey, wrote on something today. You know, Chris Jacobs, you know, Chris, he wrote about the Massey proposal. I think these things are all going to result in, effectively, a continuation of the status quo, a spending freeze for a couple of years. It's a slowdown. But it's like being at the Indy 500. You're going 240 miles an hour down the stretch, and you're coming up at the wall, and you go, oh, I'm going to let my foot off the brake a little bit, and boom, you hit the wall. Like, that's where we're headed.
One other question on this. There have been a few people making a few noises about, you know, revisiting the leadership battle that we all watched in January because people were mad at McCarthy. Is that something that you are taking seriously here? Is this the type of deal that would threaten the speakership of Kevin McCarthy in your mind, or is that just kind of noise?
Well, look, let me just say two things. One, Kevin has been working with us all through this spring in good faith, and I'd like to return to that. I feel like this last week was not ideal. I think they cut a deal in the pressure of the moment that wasn't good. I think that deal that was cut does not completely comport with a lot of the agreements that we had, you know, when we had a meeting of the minds in January, and I want to revisit that because that was a part of how that all came together. I don't like red lines. I don't like threats. But what I said last week when people asked is I think there's going to need to be a bit of a reckoning and a kind of review of how we're organizing ourselves in order to get things done. Because what broke down this week was that we weren't all sitting around the table. It's not like, you know, it came back and said, okay, guys, here's the deal. Here's what was offered. They basically just cut the deal and then told us. And we had to react because now we're being asked to respond and vote on a deal that was cut, not with our approval. And I was happy to give him a lot of rope, you know, go out there, do what you can, but you got to kind of come back. So we got to have a sit down. I will say that. And I'm going to stay away from all that kind of.
Is he open,
you know,
to that? Like, have you spoken with him? Is he?
Yep. I don't like to talk about private conversations,
okay,
but I will say in broad terms, we have spoken. Yes, that's no magic, and we will sit down next week, and we need to. I mean, look, there needs to be a review of all of this. And look, some in the conference are mad at some of us for voting against the rule. But we could not in good conscience vote for a rule that was essentially proceeding to legislation that was in direct contradiction to everything we had agreed to with respect to the spending levels we would fight.
Yeah, so some of the frustration flows in different directions in some of this stuff, which is what happens when you have a relatively big tent, kind of a motley crew. I think talking through it's a good idea. Sounds like that's going to happen, which sounds good to me. Chip Roy, one of the leading voices in those conversations, congressman from Texas, Texas 21. Congressman, always appreciate your time.
Great to be on, Guy. You have a great weekend.
You too. We'll step aside, come right back. It is the Guy Benson Show. I'm Guy Benson. We're back. Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida is on this blitz around the country. He spent several days in Iowa. Now he's in New Hampshire. I saw him speaking earlier in Salem, making the rounds, making his case to voters. I meant to play some of this audio the other day, just didn't get around to it with breaking news and debt ceiling stuff. But I actually found it very interesting because we did our analysis here of the rollout on Twitter and the tech glitches and all of that. And I was critical in a number of ways, even though I'm generally supportive of his presidential run, very open about these things. But I thought that that was a mistake, the way that they did it, the way it went down as the very first event of his very first day of this hotly anticipated for a long time presidential campaign. There was also the other side of it, which was all the attention that it drew, other metrics in terms of eyeballs, ears, donors, and that sort of thing. Millions of people, millions, went and listened to that Twitter space, including the folks over at The Breakfast Club, which is a very popular lefty podcast, with the primary host being a guy called Charlemagne the God. That's what he goes by. You might remember that was the show, I believe, where Joe Biden made the "you ain't black" comment. And they have a big audience. They are distinctly left of center. They cater heavily to a black audience. And the team at The Breakfast Club actually went and listened to the announcement from DeSantis and then the conversation with Elon Musk. And their reaction to it was very different from most of the political and media elites. Whether it's representative of other people, I don't know, but it's definitely a separate and distinct take and an interesting one from people who are not necessarily in sort of the groupthink mentality of the Beltway New York corridor and the people who obsess about politics and optics all the time. Like, these are political people. They pay attention to issues, but it's sometimes unpredictable, which is why I think they're very popular. And sometimes the way they go about things, it can be refreshing. I mean, some of the stuff they said just to the face of Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, they are not afraid to mix it up with politicians, quote unquote, on their side, or to be intellectually honest about what they're seeing and feeling from politicians who they might not agree with. So one of the co-hosts, sort of part of the ensemble, is a woman named Teslin Figaro. And she was talking about her experience listening to that hour-long presentation, the interview, the exchange, DeSantis holding forth on a bunch of issues, big and more niche. Here's what she said in Cut 21.
They can laugh at the glitches, you know, all they want, but I listened to the entire thing. And of course, okay, it's funny, a glitch, but the bottom line is this man spent an hour having a very long, detailed conversation that to his base. They were able to educate them. They were able to say things. One of the actual co-hosts said that they look at Ron DeSantis as a cool-headed, ruthless assassin to take on the woke mob. So it was an hour-long conversation of saying, you know, this is what they need to do to get rid of, you know, many things that he's already talked about, such as, you know, banning books and ending diversity programs. And so it was a real time, you know, to educate their base. And it was it actually made me very upset, Charlamagne, to be honest with you. You know, but I've been talking for years about how, you know, I wish we used, shout out to the Breakfast Club for using their platform, you know, to educate our voters. And I just don't think that we do that enough.
So she was upset, not because she disagreed, and she does disagree, in the way that she framed it in some ways made it clear that she doesn't agree with DeSantis. But to hear the substantive hour-long conversation, having an adult conversation, she was upset because she was impressed and saying, actually, it doesn't seem like our folks, our leaders on our side, really have those types of discussions. So the conversation went on in Cut 22.
And I'm not talking about Democrat or Republican. I'm talking about just black people in general. They talked about education. They talked about transportation. They talked about immigration. They even talked about Bitcoin, which is something that you don't normally hear, you know, in the mainstream media. So they can laugh at this if they want to, but the bottom line is Democrats shouldn't be laughing and should be focusing on why he has $200 million that they're going to spend on 2,600 field organizers knocking on doors. 2,600 is a very large amount, you know, to be having folks out there pushing their message. And so they should absolutely be concerned.
Tez, I agree with you 100%. And I think it's strange that they would bring so much attention to his Twitter space by talking about the glitch. But I didn't see anybody, you know, pushing back on the things that you just said. Like, they should be presenting their policies after you hear Ron DeSantis present his for an hour. I don't hear none of that. Everybody's just trying to clown him for the glitch. But all you're doing is bringing attention to all of the things that you just said.
And here's the conclusion of that back and forth. Again, this is very much not what you heard almost anywhere in the media. These are folks on the left looking and actually respecting what happened on the underlying issues and the seriousness of the conversation and the threat clearly that they believe DeSantis presents to Democrats, and saying, why don't we get this from our side? From Democrats, especially vis-a-vis black people, they're saying this out loud. It is not the conventional wisdom. And these are people who are not conventional Republican or conservative voters, obviously, looking in from an outsider's perspective and giving their take on that opening salvo from DeSantis in the Twitter space that was widely derided among the smart set. Here again is that conclusion that I mentioned, Cut 23.
Now, like Tess said, they're laughing and they're joking about the small things, but the things that they should be talking about, they're not discussing. And it seems like, especially with the Democratic Party, that's what it always happens.
Yeah, tell me what y'all doing. Ron just told us what he's doing for an hour. Tell me what y'all doing.
That's right.
Telling me about his glitch.
And it's not funny. You know, like, okay, it's all jokes and, you know, Biden sending out, hey, this link works, you know, let's donate. No. squash that. Like, real stuff was, I mean, substantive stuff, Charlamagne, seriously. And when you compare DeSantis to Trump, which people have heard this many times before, DeSantis actually knows how to govern. You know, he's actually, mm-hmm. he was able to present receipts. And when I say know how to govern, I'm not saying I agree with his policies. I'm saying he knows how to work around the system. He mm-hmm. knows how to get things done, even if I completely disagree. And he laid out all of those receipts. So when you compare him to Trump, it is night and day as far as substance is concerned.
No doubt about that. It's just interesting to hear that considering the source. And they're not saying that really as a compliment necessarily, like a go Ron DeSantis. It is, we are concerned about Ron DeSantis for these reasons. He knows how to get things done, knows how to govern on substance. I found that fascinating. The type of conversation you don't hear a lot in our media. Part of the reason why I think the Breakfast Club has the cachet and the influence that it does. The Guy Benson Show is back right after this.
America is listening to The Guy Benson Show.
Glad to have you here on The Guy Benson Show from New York City. Halfway through the program on this Thursday, GuyBensonShow.com, GuyBensonShow.com, where you can get the podcast for free every day, plus bonus Benson on the weekends. With us now from Capitol Hill is Chad Pergram, senior congressional correspondent here at Fox News. Chad, as always, it's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. So let's start with what happened yesterday. We covered it as it unfolded on the rules vote. And then into the evening, there was debate, there were speeches, and then the tallies were counted up. And it was a pretty substantial win for this debt ceiling deal. A lot of votes from each party, a lot of opposition from each party, but the yeas had it by a pretty good margin. What's the significance in your mind of seeing this all come together? Because there was a lot of drama, and then at the very end, it seemed like the floodgates opened.
Yeah, well, you certainly had a lot of Democrats who were waiting to see how many votes the Republicans could put up. They are in the majority. And Hakeem Jeffries, the Democratic leader, a couple of days ago, he kind of threw down the gauntlet to House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, saying, you know, this will be fine if the majority Republicans can put up, 150 of their members. You know, they have 223. Well, they didn't quite get there. They got to 149. That's still pretty substantial. I guess in one universe, looking at this, just the fact that Kevin McCarthy could persuade 149 Republicans to vote to increase the debt ceiling or suspend the debt ceiling through early 2025. I mean, that's a big win in that sense. There's a lot of conservatives who don't like that, but just the idea that that happened, that's a sea change here on Capitol Hill. But it also showed that Democrats, when it comes to these types of issues, governing and kind of, carrying the freight, they're in the minority and they were willing to kind of take one on the chin because, they're always just, harassed by the Republicans for just being for more debt. And so they were like, OK, guys, if you have to raise the debt ceiling, this is an agreement between the speaker and the president. Let's let some of the Republicans do the dirty work. They did to some degree, but Democrats still, waited to see how many votes the Republicans would put up, and then they weighed in. But the fact that they got 317 votes for this, and the one thing that was kind of lost, I don't know if you were watching our coverage yesterday, Guy, when they were trying to get the rule through, the rule, and explain to the listeners, this is where you have to, agree to the rules about how you're going to debate the bill on the floor. You can't bring the bill to the floor unless you agree to the rule first. That was going down. And Democrats really waited to see, how many Republicans were going to defect there. There were a bunch. They could only lose four. And they were, dozens, beyond that. And so they waited till the end and they provided the votes and kind of bailed out the Republicans. That was, very significant because it showed that, that there was this attrition on the Republican side of the aisle. And the fact that they got 317 votes, there's something in the House called a suspension bill. This is where you don't need a rule to put the bill on the floor. You suspend the rules and you just put it on the floor. The debate is very limited and you need a 2/3 vote to pass it. Well, guess what? If you got 317 votes, you're well above 2/3. 2/3 on that vote yesterday would have been 288. So they didn't need to go actually through these machinations. But what that tells me is that nobody really, really knew, Guy, how many votes there were for this or against that. And that is very telling because it's a very hard vote to whip.
But you ended up having a majority of the majority voting yes and a majority of the minority party voting yes, hence the very big number. And I know that opponents of the bill are sort of licking their wounds. Some of them are angry, but they did this through the normal process. And now it seems to me like it's off to the next battle. Now, most immediately, Chad, we look to the U.S. Senate. The House was largely seen by most observers as the toughest hurdle because Republicans control it, a lot of the dynamics that you were just alluding to. And it was, to your point, both Speaker McCarthy's deal, which is why he got a lot of Republicans on board, but the Democrats, you said they took it on the chin, but also they were voting in support of something Joe Biden and the White House had blessed, their own party. So it kind of worked the way that compromises, at least in theory, would work, right? And that's sometimes a trickier thing to get done in a more ideological House, especially with a very tight margin. In the Senate, sometimes you will get bigger margins. So is there any real drama around what will happen in the Senate in terms of final passage? Is there a filibuster-proof majority in favor of this bill in the upper chamber? What does the timeline look like in the Senate?
Yeah, there are no dummies in the Senate where they see 317 votes on the scoreboard in the House, and they're like, we are not going to get in the way of this legislative train that is coming down the parliamentary tracks. We are going to vote for this. They will have 60 votes for this to overcome a filibuster. As to some of these proposals, you know, Mike Lee has a proposal, an amendment. Tim Kaine, the Democrat from Virginia, he has an amendment here. He says he wants to take out the approval of the Mountain Valley Pipeline, which was a component of this bill. He says that has nothing to do with the debt ceiling, which is true. You also have a proposal by Rand Paul, Republican senator from Kentucky. So here's what they usually do. It's just a question of when this will pass. And what they do is they often subject these amendments. They will work out an agreement where they'll say, okay, you get so many minutes of debate, you'll get a vote on your amendment, but they will subject it to a 60-vote threshold. Now, the joke is that they will make sure by subjecting it to 60 votes that, you know, this is not going to kill the bill. Because if you were to change the bill at this point, in other words, make one of these amendments, actually copy it onto the bill, it has to go back to the House
right,
of Representatives.
Right, because then it's changed. It's new legislation at that point.
That's right. So these are people just kind of making sure that they get on the record about what their issue is, their reservations with the bill, can go to their constituents and say, I fought, you know, Tim Kaine about his amendment with the Mountain Valley Pipeline. He said, I think that we shouldn't be blowing up the usual approval process for this. I have people affected by this in Western Virginia. And so I want to, you know, show them that I fought. And so that's what you do. Because otherwise, I mean, the alternative then is to default. You know, so how do you weigh that?
Let me ask about default, because the date on the calendar from Janet Yellen, Treasury Secretary, now for many weeks has been June 1st, which, if I check my watch right now, Chad, is today, right? So the House passed this last night. The default, at least theoretically, would get rolling today. I know it's not necessarily that simple. It's not like, oh, you flip a switch and we're in default. They probably have a tiny handful of last-minute extraordinary measures just to sort of prioritize certain things, especially since they're so close, apparently, to dealing with the issue legislatively. But there is still at least some component of a time pressure here. So the Senate doesn't always go very smoothly. It's not always the type of body where things move through at lightning speed, to put it mildly. Is there an expectation, given the fact that this will clear that 60-vote hurdle, that this will get done today or tomorrow? I know there has to be debate around some of these amendments that you're talking about, debate around the bill as well. What are we looking at there?
John Thune, the Republican whip, indicated earlier that he thought it might be more like tomorrow, although some sources have told me, you know, they might actually get this done tonight very late. Probably at the very latest at this stage is Saturday. I don't think that's going to be the scenario. It's going to be tonight or tomorrow. It might be late tomorrow night. But to show how dangerously close they are to this deadline here, nobody has picked up on this. And I look for these little things in the financial world, which tell you a lot. The Treasury Department has delayed next week's three-month and six-month T-bill auctions due to the debt ceiling, which remains right now unresolved. Now, it's going to be resolved, but the fact that they have postponed these auctions at Treasury, that tells me a lot, because if you had everything signed, sealed, and delivered, you know, they have to make decisions. They're like, okay, they passed it through the House, but they've not passed it through the Senate. There's no guarantee that we should even be auctioning off these T-bills and bonds. That's a problem, because if they didn't get this through the House the other day, those types of issues start to cascade on Wall Street, or, you know, other things that they were, you know, other indicators, credit default swaps. We noticed that that was a problem a few weeks ago. Some very, you know, granular, you know, in the weeds kind of financial indicators here. But those things were starting to happen. And that's why, regardless of what the deadline was, and everybody kind of said, OK, we think the 5th is the deadline now. You know, not having this done does not exactly soothe the markets. And that's what Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, said the other day. He said, if we get this done, this will soothe the markets.
Okay, a couple things moving forward here, Chad. I know that a lot of people and listeners in this audience, and as me personally, it gets very tiresome to have at least once a year, it seems, a giant cliff of some sort that DC has created for itself. Some big emergency that has to be averted with some kind of deal at the very last minute, and everyone's worried. Usually it gets dealt with sooner or later. What's the next one? Because, all right, check the box. This one is now punted into 2025. But that doesn't mean that other things have been dealt with or averted, right? There could still be government funding, battles to come. What goodies does Washington still have in store for us?
Really, the only thing that they have to do besides this year is fund the government. And the due date there is the end of September, September 30th. That's the end of the government's fiscal year. And, you know, there's going to be certain provisions in this agreement that Republicans looked for to say, what were the spending arrangements? How did it work? You know, there's this whole thing that if they don't have all 12 of the appropriations bills passed, you basically go to an interim spending bill, but it brings down the level of spending for several months. This is something that Thomas Massie, the Republican from Kentucky, wanted. And, you know, every time that we get some sort of an agreement like this, you see, this agreement right now only has to deal with the debt ceiling. There's a lot of other ancillary paper with this. When you're dealing with appropriations, you are firing with live ammo. There's no live ammo in this exercise the past couple of days. And so when it gets to September, and Kevin McCarthy and Chuck Schumer and President Biden, and they realize, okay, we've not funded the government, you start to suspend those agreements sometimes. And I'm just, you know, speaking from experience, you know, the best example of this was in 2011, after the last debt ceiling crisis that we had. The plan was to have a super committee, which was going to come in and recommend a certain number of cuts. And it was going to reach a certain dollar figure. And then the House and Senate would vote on this. Well, the threat to make sure that the super committee succeeded was sequestration. Mm-hmm. We've heard that term now for years, which was a mandatory cut in federal spending. Well, they never succeeded on the super committee, and so they continue to have these cuts via sequestration. So you can see where the plan right now is, well, of course they will approve the 12 annual spending bills because the threat is much worse than what would happen in September. There is no guarantee of that. The track record on that type of thing here in Washington, Guy, is really bad.
Well, and I had read that it wouldn't even kick in, the requirement for regular order in all the 12 committees, until next year.
Is that next fiscal year?
Right.
See, that's fiscal 2024.
Right.
I think
right.
That's what they're alluding to, which starts October 1st. You see, so that's where you have to get those there. And again, if you're operating on a CR, you know, I talked to Thomas Massie the other night. I said, what if they were to do an omnibus spending bill? He said, Kevin McCarthy says no omnibus. That's where they do all 12 of the bills together. I said, how about, and this is where we get cute in Washington, I said, how about a minibus? Now, a minibus is what they do, is they put like two or three or five of these bills together. And apparently, according to Thomas Massie, they didn't say that. So does that count? You know, that's glomming these bills together. Or maybe that was the wink and the nod. We're not going to do an omnibus, but we can easily do it with an omnibus. I'm sorry, a minibus or a series of minibuses. Ooh. So you get to all 12.
It's very technical.
We'll know in September. Yeah.
People hate the omnibus process because it's like, you know, jamming a bunch of stuff in at the dead of night. And then like, all right, here's all the paperwork. Here's the final price tag. Yes or no. We're up against it. People hate that. And anything you can do to bring things back toward regular order, I think, is probably progress and a win. Whether you break up the omnibus into slightly smaller ones and call them minibuses, maybe that's a little bit better, but I don't know. So I guess we'll all find out together. Isn't that exciting to look forward to a couple months from now? Chad Pergram, on a granular level, following all of it on Capitol Hill, which is where he joins us from today, our senior congressional correspondent here at Fox News. Chad, appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And the Guy Benson Show resumes after this short break.
A fresh perspective on the topics of the day. It's Guy Benson.
Back on the Guy Benson Show. How appropriate if you're listening on the broadcast. This is a club banger for Pride Month. This is Euphoria by a woman. Okay, so I do not follow Eurovision. I don't know anything about Eurovision, really, except that it exists. And I think ABBA came out of it. But it's a big thing over there, and I see people, my friends in Europe, tweeting about it once a year. The woman who won Eurovision this year, I think from Sweden, but I'm not 100% sure about that. Clearly, I did my homework for this. She had previously won. Loreen, that's her name? Okay, thank you, Dan. Loreen had previously won in 2012. I didn't realize you could come back and win again. I thought it was, hey, you've won Eurovision, congratulations, next. But I guess more than a decade later, Loreen back and winning again. The song that I just played on the broadcast for our bumper, a brand new edition. It's called Euphoria, and it was her 2012 winning song. Had never heard of it. I saw it on social media. It's like, well, this is an absolute bop. And then I heard it on a Peloton ride yesterday from a gay instructor. So I'm like, yep, that checks out. Now you're going to YouTube this, aren't you? Right? Because if you're listening on the podcast, you couldn't hear the song. If you're listening live, that was just a tantalizing little tiny snippet. It's just a good pop song. Christine has a question.
Well, more of a statement. It's just no Nickelback.
Oh, stop. That is deeply offensive. You've just offended all of Europe, which is actually kind of fine. So yeah, check out the chorus is what gets you with Euphoria. I heard it was very big in the clubs for years. This might come as a shock. I don't do a lot of time in the clubs. I'm not in there with glow sticks and glitter dancing the night away on a regular basis. That's not really my thing. There was supposed to be something we were doing this segment, and now we've gone way down this rabbit hole. Oh, yeah, that's what it was. It was Pride. So it's June 1st, Pride Month. I've said a few things about this in the lead up to it and a lot of the culture war fights that have been already percolating, if not raging. And we'll be talking coming up in the next hour with Will Kane about how some of those culture wars around Pride Month have now manifested and gotten fairly ugly in the world of sports. Looking forward to chatting with Will Kane about that. There's a lot surrounding Pride that has nothing to do with me, that I want nothing to do with. I'm sort of a two-each-their-own type of person. But earlier today, not to belabor the point or dwell on it, I put a little Twitter thread together about my actual thoughts on Pride Month. Speaking only for myself, I said it's Pride Month, which means it's time for a lot of noise, from corporate posturing to culture warriors' endless competing grievances. Sometimes they have a point on both sides. There are any number of things Pride doesn't mean to me, but here's what it does. I'm living my life to the fullest as best I know how, while being truthful about who I am, a gay man. For years, I never expected this sort of life would be possible or accessible to someone like me. Despite my fear, I've never regretted finally accepting and sharing that truth. It gets better isn't just a trite slogan to me. It's been a powerful reality. While everyone's situations and timelines are different, I believe that phrase, it gets better, applies to the vast majority of cases. Despite our immense progress, there are still many people who need to hear that. Crucially, I'm grateful to those who forged this path when it was so bleak and hard, and to the many people, family, friends, colleagues, strangers, who've embraced me and my family, treating us with kindness and respect, regardless of identity, faith, or political affiliation. We are unspeakably blessed to be free, living this life in this great country. That is what truly makes me proud and thankful today and every day. P.S. to those who maybe been out of shape over this thread, for whatever reason, I preemptively don't care. Final hour of the Guy Benson Show coming up. Will Kane is here next.
Raise your glass to the Guy Benson Show Happy Hour. Brought to you by the Finnish Long Drink. Finland's most popular alcoholic beverage is taking America by storm. Visit thelongdrink.com. And now, here's Guy Benson.
It's the Thursday happy hour from New York City on The Guy Benson Show, GuyBensonShow.com. Podcast always free on demand. Catch me tonight on Kennedy, a big one. I hope to see you there in the 7 p.m. hour Eastern, FBN. And then Gutfeld tonight at 11 Eastern on FNC. Here at the radio show, the podcast is free on demand, GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcast.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. This hour brought to you by the Finnish Long Drink. Some big news on that front here on the show tomorrow, so stay tuned for that. Always drink responsibly, 21 plus only, TheLongDrink.com. Joining us now is Will Kane, co-host of Fox & Friends Weekend, 6 to 10 a.m. Eastern, Saturday and Sunday. Also host of the popular Will Kane podcast at FoxNewsPodcast.com. Will, always enjoy it. Thanks for being here.
Hey, guy. Happy to be here.
All right, so let's start with this. There's been this fight in Los Angeles over an invite of this pretty outrageous group called the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, which is this drag group that does performances and fundraisers and that kind of thing. They were initially invited by the Dodgers to be part of Pride Night at Dodger Stadium. Then a number of the things that this group does, which I think a lot of people would absolutely consider sacrilegious, they said, well, hold on. Is this something that we want to feature at the ballpark? And initially the Dodgers said, okay, upon further review, we're going to rescind that particular invitation. We're still doing Pride Night. Can't wait. But the sisters, this group, mocking Catholic nuns, crucifixion stuff, we're not going to be a part of that. Then, apparently behind the scenes, they received an enormous amount of pressure and backlash from certain LGBT activists. And they were then out with a brand new statement, festooned with different rainbow-type graphics saying, our bad, just kidding, the sisters are back in, and we are so, so sorry that we ever offended them or this community. And basically, the Christians and the Catholics who objected can then go pound sand. So that's where we stand, leading into now some disappointment and anger and frustration being voiced by members of the Los Angeles Dodgers, like members of the team, including one of their stars. I just wonder, before I get into some of the statements that are being released back and forth on this, what you make of this whole flap up till this point. It seems like a real mess that the Dodgers have completely created for themselves.
No doubt about it. And there are many different ways in which we can go with this conversation and should, including the way that several players have spoken out, from Clayton Kershaw to Anthony Bass to Trevor Williams. Several players who said that I consider this an offense to my religion, some of whom have gone back now and apologized, seemingly at the behest of Major League Baseball or their teams. But here's where I think you ultimately have to go. All of that is a little bit window dressing on the deeper issue in these stories, and I think it represents two things, Guy. First, the expanding umbrella of tolerance, I'll put that in quotation marks, as the LGBTQI2S plus grievance alphabet expands, you have to acknowledge there are frontiers within that expanse. I think the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence represent one of those frontiers. What I mean is the outliers, the extreme. And it's worth asking here on this point, what is the next frontier? Because there is always another frontier. You know, we're far removed from the day of having a conversation when you and I first met, Guy, about gay marriage. We're long past that as the civil rights issue of our time. The Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence make a mockery of Catholicism, dress up as nuns, do all sorts of things that I wonder if a person says, hey, I find that offensive, how is that wrong or illogical? It was intended to offend. But whatever, that's where the Dodgers, that's where Major League Baseball, that's where they find they now have to accept under the umbrella of tolerance. So what is tomorrow? And I don't think that's like the slippery slope argument, because we are sliding down the hill on a sled so fast, covered in ice, that it expands by the day. So what is tomorrow required of the Dodgers to avoid the label of bigotry? What needs to be included in Pride Month or Pride Night or whatever it may be for any organization to be safe? I think that's a very important question, because I think it does lead us towards what this movement is ultimately about. I'm going to quickly, Guy, the second point is there is always going to be this inherent tension with religion. And it's not just Christianity, obviously. It's any religion who has as part of its tenants judgment on behavior.
Well, although just to jump in, Will, I think we all understand that this group of, you know, drag nuns and some of the stuff you watch, some of the videos with someone depicting Christ on a cross and being twerked on and all that stuff. I mean, it's really, really out there. The equivalent of that group mocking, let's just say, a different major religion in the world, I don't think would exist in this country and certainly would absolutely never in a thousand years be included in any sort of mainstream event, right? I think we can agree on that. We understand why, which I think is angering to a lot of Christians, but it's something worth pointing out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And by the way, these people who consider themselves so brave as activist intolerance, talk to me when you desecrate a Quran, you know? I don't think if you're so brave in your pushback against intolerance, well, I don't see you depicting Muhammad.
Call yourself Muhammad's wives or something like that and go do a drag performance about that and just see how that goes. See if the Los Angeles Dodgers offer you an invite to Pride Night. I can guess how it might go, and I think there's a reason why people aren't pursuing that path.
Yeah, and I think, by the way, if we're ranking Catholicism, even in its most strict forms, to Islamism, which one has exhibited more intolerance towards the letters in this alphabet? You know, which one would be the bigger stand to make?
Yeah, Catholics aren't throwing gay people off of roofs to their deaths.
Exactly. You know, but the second point I was making on this inherent tension with any type of religion, what happens is, you know, religion, almost all of them do put certain behaviors outside the realms of what they define as virtue, right? And in this movement, the movement is one to push back on that judgment. They would call it intolerance. So what happens is because of this constantly creeping frontier, because it's always on offense, because it's always adding letters, because it's always asking what's the next thing that in order to avoid the label of bigotry you must tolerate, it's going to smash headlong into the judgment of religion. And in that, as a society, we are going to have to ask, you know, is the end result of this that religion is bigotry? Is the end result of this that you have to live in a judgment-free society? Is everything supposed to be tolerated? What is the purpose of the movement, acknowledging that it never ends and smashes into any type, not just of institutionalized judgment, but personalized judgment? You know, people walk around out there, I didn't feel right. You know, twerking on the Jesus Christ, I don't feel right. Oh, you don't think they feel that's right? Oh, you bigot.
Right, and I think that there are limits to that, which is why the pushback has been pretty fierce recently in a few different areas. And then you see the wringing of the hands saying, oh, we're going backwards. No, I think that there are certain hardcore activists trying to push things as far as humanly possible. And some people are just, including a lot of people who are very pro-gay rights, pro-gay marriage, they say, no, my line in the sand was over there. You've blown past that already. I'm against that. And I think that the fear of being called a bigot on some of this stuff might be ebbing because of how intense it's getting. So I mentioned some of the Dodgers themselves are criticizing their own organization over this, including one of their star pitchers, Clayton Kershaw. He's now organizing Christian Faith Day at the ballpark as part of his protest. He said we sort of moved up plans for that because he's upset about what's happened. There's also a player on the Dodgers, Blake Treinen, who put out a statement on this. I just want to read it, Will. I don't know if you've seen it yet. But he wrote this: I am disappointed to see the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence being honored as heroes at Dodger Stadium. Many of their performances are blasphemous, and their work only displays hate and mockery of Catholics and the Christian faith. I understand that playing baseball is a privilege and not a right. My convictions in Jesus Christ will always come first. Since I have been with the Dodgers, they have been at the forefront of supporting a wide variety of groups. However, inviting the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence to perform disenfranchises a large community and promotes hate of Christians and people of faith. This single event alienates the fans and supporters of the Dodgers, Major League Baseball, and professional sports. People like baseball for its entertainment value and competition. The fans do not want propaganda or politics forced on them. The debacle with Bud Light and Target should be a warning to companies and professional sports to stay true to their brand and leave the propaganda and politics off the field. I believe in Jesus Christ, that he died on the cross for my sins. I believe the word of God is true, and in Galatians 6:7, It says, do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows. This group openly mocks Jesus Christ, the cornerstone of my faith. And I want to make it clear that I do not agree with nor support the decision of the Dodgers to, quote, honor the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. Quote, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Joshua 24:15, signed Blake Treinen of the Dodgers. That is a statement, Will. Wow.
Yeah, it is. That is unapologetic. That is strong. That is so interesting. And, you know, it's especially interesting in the wake. And, you know, who knows what kind of pressure came to bear on Anthony Bass, who started this kind of started with Anthony Bass, the Toronto Blue Jays pitcher, who all he did, I think, is repost a story from somebody else's words on his Instagram story.
It was something. So he had effectively amplified something supporting the boycotts of Target and Bud Light based on some of the trans stuff and the LGBT stuff. And I have complicated and nuanced thoughts about both of those boycotts that probably don't fit into a quick, snappy soundbite here. But I understand why people are pushing back. I saw someone on MSNBC called the boycotters terrorists the other day, which is very interesting, given this is kind of the left's playbook. They would never consider their boycott actions to try to affect change to be terrorism. I guess it's only when one side does it. But Anthony Bass on the Blue Jays had promoted in some way these boycotts. And boy, did he get a talking to, obviously, because he came out the next day. We have the soundbite. We're up on a break, so let's take it and then play that clip as soon as we come back with Will Cain here on The Guy Benson Show.
New talk for a new generation. The Guy Benson Show.
Back on The Guy Benson Show Happy Hour, Will Cain is with us. We're talking about Anthony Bass, Major League Baseball player, who posted something on social media about some boycotts of Bud Light and Target, and then walked it all back. Here's the abject apology in front of the media from this Blue Jays pitcher in Cut 28.
I recognized yesterday I made a post that was hurtful to the Pride community, which includes friends of mine and close family members of mine, and I am truly sorry for that. I just spoke with my teammates and shared with them my actions yesterday. I apologized with them. And as of right now, I'm using the Blue Jays resources to better educate myself, to make better decisions moving forward. The ballpark is for everybody. We include all fans at the ballpark, and we want to welcome everybody. That's all I have to say.
Okay, so a big apology, the whole requisite, I'm going to use resources to educate myself and make better decisions. You know, Will, first of all, I thought that the big thing that we all agreed with recently was athletes shouldn't shut up and play. They should absolutely use their platform to stand for things that they believe in. But I guess, again, there's an asterisk there. I guess it's only if you believe left-wing things, then we have to celebrate the athletes for what they're saying. But if you're Anthony Bass, you're going to be brought to heel because you're supporting a boycott that millions of people in the country are supporting. I mean, he obviously was told that this was not going to be acceptable and decided to come out and give this groveling apology. And unfortunately, it's kind of shades of what the Dodgers did, making a decision and then backtracking and prostrating themselves in front of a handful of very loud, angry people.
Yeah, I mean, you're just going to need strong people in this world, like that Dodgers statement, Dodgers player statement you just read. I mean, that's a real shame for Anthony Bass. And like I said, I can't imagine. I don't know what kind of pressure came to bear. We're going to take your living away. I don't know what they said. Who knows? I'll make a pretty strong wager. It wasn't the locker room, saying, oh, we can't play with you. I don't know what it was. But I would ask you this. I don't know how much time you have left in your segment, Guy. But like, I look at this and I say, okay. I think it was a Nancy Armour just wrote a column where she called ESPN's, I think she called Sam Ponder a bigot,
yep,
or something.
For supporting Riley Gaines, the swimmer.
For support, yeah. It's like this, like you said, maybe this like slur of calling people bigots loses. I mean, it's a dull knife for me personally, and it's not for the Dodgers. It's clearly a sharp knife for the Dodgers, right? So I don't know when it loses its power. But what's going to happen is it continues to expand back to my initial point. And I just wonder, like, what comes next? And I don't know if you and I've ever had this conversation on or off air, but I do wonder, for something that started out like LGB, right? Like, at what point does you're like, whoa, this, what is this? Pride Month was about lesbian, gay, and bisexual, right? And then T, and then Q, and then I don't even know what the sisterhood of perpetual indulgence represents, you know. But if the barriers continue, if the umbrella continues, the frontier continues to be pushed, at some point, don't the other letters in that alphabet go, what, how does this represent me? This
oh, yeah,
is
and
not
I did,
what I stood for.
Last week, Will, I did a long 3-segment monologue on exactly that. It was gay rights. Now it's a bigger tent, and I'm open to that, except all of a sudden you turn around, and it's like all of the focus seems to be on not just tea, but tea stuff for children. You're like, well, hold on. I didn't sign up for that. That actually bears no resemblance to my life or my values. Why am I being grouped in with that particular agenda? That's why I think it's sort of incumbent on people like me to raise my hand and say things about it, which is why I do. And I get blowback and support, and I did last week, and I'm sure I will again. Just one more point on this, and I want to shout out Sam Ponder at ESPN, who you mentioned. She came right back. She was called a bigot publicly by a columnist for supporting Riley Gaines, and she said, no, biology is not bigotry. She's standing up for herself, and good for her. She's allowed to have those completely mainstream opinions backed by science. And she's not going to be bullied, at least on this point. So I wanted to applaud her for that. Secondly, just on that soundbite we played from Anthony Bass saying, look, the ballpark's for everyone. Sports is for everyone. That is, I think, overall the correct message, at least that component of it. Except that's not the message that we've gotten recently for Major League Baseball, where they said, well, actually, if you support Republicans in Georgia or Brian Kemp, you're part of voter suppression and racism. So we're going to punish your state and your city and your team and take the All-Star game out because politics is something that sports needs to pay attention to. But I guess like it's sort of they can just change the rules depending on whether the message is something that they like and is acceptable to certain audiences, certain activists. That's part of the thing that drives me crazy, Will. Last word to you, 20 seconds.
I would just say that you're exactly right in your analysis. By the way, I like Sam Ponder. I know Sam Ponder, and I agree. I'm proud of her and being strong there, not in a patronizing way, just in an admiration way. And then the last thing is, I don't think Major League Baseball is full of a bunch of people that believe this stuff. I think, like Anthony Bass, our society is full of people with weakness.
Yep, and I think that's why pressure tends to work. When pressure only comes from one side, you get certain results, and that's why you're seeing more pressure from another side now. And the people who love playing the pressure games and pressure points, they don't love that. But guess what? This is the culture war that you have foisted upon society, and there's going to be blowback, and we're in the middle of it, which is why we're having these conversations with Will Kane, co-host of Fox and Friends Weekend. You can catch that Saturday and Sunday from 6 to 10 Eastern on Fox News Channel. And the Will Kane Podcast, foxnewspodcast.com. Will, thank you.
Thanks, man.
I'll be right back.
In the swamp, not of the swamp. Guy Benson.
Earlier today on the Guy Benson Show, Congressman Chip Roy of Texas joined us here talking about the debt ceiling deal that he opposed adamantly, but it did pass last night. He's none too pleased about that. What comes next? What's he thinking? Here's part of what we discussed with Congressman Roy earlier. Do you have any sense that there could be movement in the Senate on this, or is this almost a done deal in your mind now?
No, it's pretty much a done deal, which is fundamentally the problem, right? I mean, for the American people out there frustrated, this is the uniparty or the cartel or whatever you want to talk about, the swamp, when it does what it does to just, hey, guys, we have to get a deal done, so do a deal. And that's what happened. It's a maybe slightly better deal than we might have had we not been negotiating all year, working to get Limit Save Grow. But it ain't a hell of a lot better. That's why I'm frustrated, right? I mean, notwithstanding the talking points from the Speaker's office and my colleagues who supported the bill, let's not forget, by the way, that more Democrats than Republicans voted for the bill, and far more Republicans than Democrats voted no. Let's not forget how many Democrats are out there today applauding it and saying, hey, can we now actually acknowledge that we got a really good deal? I mean, the fact is, it's $4 trillion for, at best, a two-year spending freeze. That's it. And I'll challenge anybody to debate me on that point. That's what it is. You can call it a massive cut, the biggest cut in history, all these words, but it's just simply not true. And anybody objectively looking at the math can say that's not true. It's effectively a two-year spending freeze. And again, you get effectively a $4 trillion debt ceiling increase. I say effectively because it's an uncapped date, right? It's January 1st, 2025. So it's an estimate that it will be about $4 trillion. It leaves in all of the subsidies, you know, for the Green New Deal, so to speak, that the Biden administration said will, quote, accelerate implementation of the historic clean energy and environmental justice investments in the Inflation Reduction Act. It's got watered-down SNAP requirements. It actually increased the number of people that will apply and would cost $2.1 billion, according to CBO. I can keep going down the list, the IRS and everything else. The bottom line is, it is what it is. The swamp won. We had a pretty good spring. We just had a big setback. And the only people applauding this are all the Wall Street types who are like, oh, my God, default.
So
most average Americans are thanking us for fighting.
So I just do want to ask you, because there were some obviously very strong conservatives who ended up voting for this deal, pointing to various provisions that they liked. I mean, you know, Thomas Massie, he is not someone who will just go along to get along. That's he votes. Sometimes he'll be the only guy voting against something on a pretty regular basis. He got something in the bill that he thought was important, so he got to yes. A guy like Jim Jordan, I don't think that people are going to say he's a bad conservative or, you know, a weak conservative. I'm not putting those words in your mouth. But are there things that you can understand why some of your very conservative colleagues eventually drew a different conclusion than you did on this?
Well, again, I always hate to talk to people. They're my talk about people and other people's votes. They're my friends. I prefer them to speak for themselves. I would make a couple of observations. The 20 who stood up in January were the 20 for a reason, and the 20 all vote no. What I mean by that is the Freedom Caucus. And by the way, some of those, like Thomas, for example, is not in the Freedom Caucus. It's not exactly all monolithic, right? And some people who get their committeeships, their committee chairmanships, they start voting a little differently. They start acting a little differently. And look, with all due respect, I don't think that the 1% addition at the end of the year, which means on January 1st, there would be a 1% cap reduction if we haven't passed all 12 appropriations bills. I don't think it'll have the effect that my friend from Kentucky thinks it will. Again, I'll let him speak for himself. I'm just saying I don't think it'll work that way. I think the swamp will basically jam an omnibus through in December using the same pressure points they just used to pass a $4 trillion debt increase.
I mean, that's entirely possible. There's a chance that maybe it'll look a little bit better because of some of these changes that they've made. Is there anything in the bill, and I know that, you know, you've made your case against it, is there anything in there that you think it's like at least not so bad? Like there's some components that are decent?
Yeah, of course. Two things. I mean, I always appreciate your show, and I always try to be honest about what I see on these things. I've been beating the snot out of it, so let me zero in. Like Garrett Graves, he's a good friend. He did, I think, good work getting some of the NEPA reforms, which are the regulatory reforms that halt a lot of the ability to produce both energy and roads. They've been long needed to get those reforms. Now, a little caveat, the problem is that if you're subsidizing green energy, you're not going to get the actual NEPA to be working for you for the non-green, i.e. the fossil fuel energy and the gas-fired plants.
My full interview with Chip Roy, Republican from Texas 21, available at GuyBensonShow.com or on our free podcast every day. It's on demand, free of charge, including bonus Benson on the weekends. GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcast.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. Again, totally free. When we come back, it's the home stretch. Well, producer Christine's husband listened to yesterday's home stretch. It got a little awkward for Christine. We have updates. Are they going to buy a new house? We'll find out right after this.
Miss a minute, miss a lot. The Guy Benson Show.
Home stretch, Thursday edition, Guy Benson Show in New York City. Thanks for listening. A reminder, please tune in tonight at 11 p.m. Eastern for Gutfeld. I'll be on the panel. Looking forward to that. Earlier in the evening, in the 7 p.m. hour Eastern, I will be on Kennedy on Fox Business Network with my very, very dear friend Kennedy, whose show has been a gem in cable news for years. Nothing like it. Nothing like her. She is just special. And it was made public yesterday. I found out yesterday, and then the news broke subsequently, that Kennedy's show will no longer continue. Tonight is the final episode of Kennedy after, I believe, 8 years. And I've had the privilege of being a guest on that show many times, to guest host that show many times. And I am honored, along with Kat Timpf and some others, to participate in the final episode tonight of Kennedy. I am so sad that this unique, fabulous, hilarious little show is coming to an end, but I'm just so proud of Kennedy and everyone involved in that show. It has been a joy to be a part of. I'm sure tonight will be no exception, perhaps a little bit emotional. So see you there in the 7 p.m. hour. That's Fox Business. And then, as I mentioned, Gutfeld later on for the late night show on Fox News Channel. Here at the radio, it's GuyBensonShow.com. Podcast always free, always on demand. And during this segment just yesterday, our topic was a new scheme by Cookie when it comes to her housing situation. She wanted to sell her house that they owned, and then she eventually got her way on that, move into an apartment. She loved the apartment, she said. Now she's already bored and tired of the apartment. She wants a new house. She's been secretly looking at a house because she got a hot tip from a realtor friend that it was coming on the market out of her price range for her and for Bobby in a very nice town. And she revealed to everyone, including her husband for the first time, yesterday during the home stretch that she's been doing this and was setting up a plan to go see the house and all of that. So, Christine, you knew that at some point Bobby would listen to the segment and discover what you were up to. What were the circumstances under which he did, in fact, listen to that segment?
Right. So I need to be careful of my time management at work and take my earlier bus because, as you know, Guy, I'm doing double duty right now. So I have to stay after and do a little bit of Y-Wise work, which leads me to take a later bus. I turn around and online is Bobby on that bus. So he gets on the bus, sits next to me. I'm not paying attention. I take a nap, and all of a sudden I feel this tap on the shoulder. Bobby's listening to Homestretch as we're sitting in traffic on the turnpike.
Right next to you.
Right next to me.
All right, so you're no longer napping.
Nope, 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 nope.
How did that go?
Not well. Not well. First he kept saying, no, it's just not happening. Like, no, 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 no. I'm like, no, no. What are you? And then he goes, Homestretch? He goes, it's really lovely as I'm sitting in traffic on the turnpike to hear, hi, Bobby. Yes, you did.
Mm-hmm.
So led to, I felt a very one-sided conversation.
Did this take place on the bus or was this after the bus?
It was a little whispering. And then once we got off the bus, I think he spent the entire night trying to explain to me why we aren't going to do this, so much so that when we got into bed last night after Vanderpump Rules, you know anything about Scandival?
Nope. I know that Kat Timpf and Tommy Lahren were talking about it in the green room a few weeks ago. That's all I got.
Gotcha.
Bravo?
Yes.
Yeah, I only watched Top Chef on Bravo. New episode tonight, by the way.
You're like Bobby. He watches that. I always turn that one off.
Oh, it's such a good show. It's the only non-trash on the whole network. But please, you watched Scandalabra or whatever.
Scandival.
And then off you went to bed and the lectures continued.
So much so that I just fell asleep while he was mid-talking.
So he was having this conversation with you about this scheme that you had hatched and were already like moving down that path. And while he was explaining to you why it was not feasible, you literally fell asleep on him.
Mm-hmm. Just okay. Completely fell asleep. Something about interest rates being so high. And I'm like, blah, blah, blah.
Did someone else mention that yesterday? I seem to remember someone else talking about that.
Did I bring that up? Dan?
Guy did.
You did?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You reacted to it during the segment. You reacted to it. I just think when things are said that you don't want to hear, they go in one ear and out the other. Correct. And it's just gone.
I feel like my childhood when my mother said that to me.
Judgy Joyce. She's right about a lot of things.
She always used to say that. What is it? Go in one ear and out the other?
Chris, pay attention, Chris.
And she always said, get it through your thick head.
I mean, I am not speaking to you that way, but I'm channeling that a little bit. So Bobby tried to make the same point that you had heard previously.
He said something about, it seemed lame to me about being house poor. And I was like, I don't even know what that means. And he's like, we're literally just spending all of our money to have this house. So he goes, I can turn back the car that we just got, the lease.
So you'd be cash poor. You'd be house rich.
Oh, I'm sorry. House rich, cash poor. Yep. Yes. So we'd be living for the house.
Yeah. And you wouldn't be able to do all the stuff that you generally want to do. Megan's dreams of Paris are definitely dead for a while. Just putting that out there. So this seems like a pretty hard no from him.
Right. And I thought the selling point was the paint. Remember I told you they would paint any color we wanted?
Yeah, and I said that was a frivolous nothing.
Didn't even care.
It doesn't matter.
And guess what? The realtor last night said to me, she goes, I am a former designer. She's like, I'll even pick the colors for you because I know what looks good. Yeah,
these are little bells and whistles to distract from more important matters such as, can we afford the house?
No. I mean, no. No, it's a stretch. You know what? When are these rates going to – all I hear about rates. When are they coming down?
Well, you need inflation to be well and truly gone. So it might be a minute.
I'm not – I know I don't usually get political here, but 2024, we get a new president that's more on the right side. Is that going to help?
A lot of things could get better, in my opinion, with better policy. No doubt about that. So are you going to give up on this now the next couple of years, it sounds like?
No. So I was out. I was down, but I was not out, actually. Okay. I spoke to a friend, pretty smart girl. She started reasoning how I can get the house and what she thinks can happen and money. And that she goes,
is it her money?
No, but she said it's totally, totally doable. Completely. So much so that she would help me. Remember I did a PowerPoint once to get that vacuum?
Yeah, I think you were going to do a PowerPoint to get a horse, too. Remember that one?
Glenn!
You were going to buy a horse. That was a big investment strategy.
I wasn't going to buy the whole horse. Remember, I was going to go partners. I wanted a partner.
Yeah, you wanted to buy, a leg of a horse. How did that PowerPoint presentation go?
Not so good. We didn't have the money we have now because we still had the house. Remember?
Right. So you were, a little more cash poor?
Oh, yeah.
You might say at the time?
Oh, yeah. So it's probably not going to happen. Never say never. I did notice something. I forgot to hit you up yesterday.
What do you mean by that?
Well,
you text me a lot. You hit me up a lot.
I mean, can we take the hint here? Do I have to spell it out for you?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Raise. Could we please talk about a raise for me?
Oh, you want me to intervene to get you a raise to make the house more doable?
Yes. I think I do a very good job for you.
So you do know that I don't make those decisions here, right?
But you have influence. You're an influencer.
Yeah. And I helped last time.
Yes, you did.
Greased the skids on a couple things, right? Mm-hmm. So there you go. But I think it's not really time for that. And I feel like budgets in a lot of places are going the different direction right now.
Oh, I forgot about that.
That's
kind of
another thing that you need to keep in mind here. I thought you were about to just straight up ask me for money out of my pocket.
No. No. Because I know you would say no.
Well.
Yeah. Thank you.
I mean, Kat. I had toyed around with it.
I just have bags of money sitting around to give to Christine to buy a house she can't afford, having never been invited to anywhere that she lives to begin with?
It would totally invite you to the new house.
See, that's a bell and whistle that is not going to distract me.
Oh, speaking of whistle, there's a train that goes right through the backyard of this house.
Oh. And that's a salient fact. I think that's the type of thing where you like a lot of the house, but then that train, when it choo-choos, wakes you up in the middle of the night for the umpteenth time, you'll be off to your next scheme for a new house, right? So it's a very big decision with timing and finances. And I believe, what's the phrase? Location, location, location. On the train tracks might not be the perfect location. Although that would certainly make it much easier for you to go get a family pony and tie that pony down to the tracks. That'd be one way to do that. But that's sort of the sick, twisted side of you. And I, again, will not encourage that. I will have no part of that. So I think it sounds, I don't want to let's knock on wood here. I don't want to get too optimistic about this, but it sounds like sanity might be prevailing on this one, with Bobby maybe winning the day for once. Stand strong, Bobby. She's talking about paint colors. You know what's up, Bobby.
Deep reds, deep greens, like the Italian colors and gold accents.
Oh, it's getting worse. It's getting worse.
What? And,
yeah, that's... She wants to do what? Christmas colors inside the house?
Well, I mean, different shades of them. It's like, you know, real Italian. And a fountain in the backyard.
Yeah. So you're talking about basically making the house much more difficult to sell on the resale side once you realize you can't handle the train noise anymore. These are bad decisions. No. My strong advice, because I can't get technical with you, because apparently it just floats away, it flies away. Let me just speak slowly. No. Bobby, you can thank me later. I should ask Bobby for some money. How much money I'm saving him through this, I should get like a little Venmo from Bobby right now. Like, thank you. It's a little sanity Venmo. You know what? It's actually a pretty good idea. We're out of time.
You can't hit my husband up for money. I'm trying to hit you up for money.
Yep, sorry. It's a vicious cycle, Christine. You started it. Kennedy tonight, a special one. 7 p.m. Eastern. Hope to see you there. Gutfeld later on, 11 p.m. Eastern on Fox News Channel. Back here tomorrow for the Friday edition, actually from Hofstra University in Long Island. Looking forward to that. We'll talk to you then. Have a great night.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day. Featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.